Tisa. Last week we had Tetzav, and that was a very heavy psychological analysis. I gave over some of it before Musaf here in a shortened form, and that was what's called Yeshus Beheder, and it was quite profound. Today, Mirza Shema, it's a little bit lighter, you know.
But you know what? When you get to Kisisa after Shlishi, you know, after the Egel, You need a space suit. Because Moshe Rabbeinu is climbing up beyond the stratosphere.
Very holy.
He's in Shemayim.
He's the Ish Elokim.
So you need to be dressed up suitably, you know, with the helmet and the to climb up.
To go up to Shemayim. But here, in the mimer that we want to do here in Hemi Nachamuni, it's a little bit lighter. So don't expect something, you know, that requires you to wear a space shoes or to button up. Okay. So let's begin by opening up the Chumash to Shmos Perek Lamed. So we'll see the psukim inside. And it says over here on page 209, because Parshas Kitisa starts actually in the middle of Perek Lamed. The first half of the Perek is dedicated to the Mizbeach HaKtores, but now we get into the mitzvah of counting Bnei Yisrael. And within the context of counting Bnei Yisrael, we have the Machtzis HaShekel, and there are many, many different details and conditions, who's obligated and how much to give, what constitutes a Machtzis HaShekel, kol overal pkudim. There are different words also that the Torah uses for Machtzis HaShekel, and we'll see all this as we go along. The Darshanim like to speak about the opening words, Kitisa, you know, which means to uplift. And, you know, we speak in the Chutzarts especially, the Darshanim speak about two types of Jews. You know, they're the faceless Jews that you can't, you know, don't rely on them. They're never there. If they're there, unfortunately, they may be on the wrong side. And especially, I can tell you, coming from the United States of America, I used to be a very proud citizen, but I don't know, we won't go into detail, but there are Jews, unfortunately, who are very, very strange from Judaism. I mean, that's just an understatement, and that's a tragic situation. But then there's Kitisa, then there are those Jews that are counted, and you can count on. Baruch Hashem. And then the Torah goes on to tell us that V'nosnu ish kofer nafsho. It seems that the purpose of this mitzvah is not just to count Bnei Yisrael. This is not just a census in the classical sense. We want to know how many Jews there are, and you don't want to count them head by head because that's a problem. So you count them by counting the Machtzis HaShekel. But on top of that, it's kofer nefesh. There's also an element here of kapara through the Machtzis HaShekel. Now, we also should point out that amongst the monies that were collected from Bnei Yisrael, especially at the time of the Mishkan, there were monies that were dedicated to what's called the Trumas HaLishka, which are the communal funds of the Migdash, of the Mishkan, that are used and earmarked for what's called a Karban Tzibur. Let's say, for example, a Karban Talmid, which is brought twice daily, had to be purchased from monies of the Trumas HaLishka. So when we talk about giving monies back at the time of the Mishkan, there are at least three purposes of those monies that we can think of. Number one, those monies were meant to avoid any problem of lo yibahem in pasuk yibes lo yibahem negef bifkodosam, meaning if we count the people of Israel, there might be a kind of an ayin hara, a negef, yeah, and we want to avoid a negef. And number two, we want a kofer nefesh. And number three, we want to beef up the treasury of the Hegdesh in order to buy Karbanos Tzibur. That's called Trumas HaLishka. And then there are different monies that were earmarked for different purposes, and that's a whole to do. Maybe we'll get into some of that today. Again, since I'm mentioning the Darshanim about 100 years ago, little bit less, I should say, there was a great darshan by the name of Amiel. Have you heard of him?
Yes.
So he wrote many works. One of them was called Drashot El Ami. And El Ami because his name was Amiel. And in those drashos for Parshas Ki Tisa has a very interesting drasha. It has nothing to do with our discussion today, but I'm just tempted to, because I know that Jeremy has to leave soon, so I want to get something in before he has to go. And he says the following. He says that back in the day, in the Jewish community, in any particular Jewish community in Europe, you wanted to know how many Jews there were in the community. All you had to do was count the members of the shul. You came into shul, every seat was taken by its member, and then you could multiply based on the average of how many members there are in each family, and you arrived at a very accurate number. That was the census. He says, but unfortunately, tragically, decades went by and that was no longer, you could no longer count the Jews by who came to shul. But what you did was you went to the butcher. And the butcher would tell you how many Jewish families order kosher meat. And then for sure you could calculate how many families there are in the community. He says, decades went by and unfortunately that's no longer true. But he says, we have another way of calculating Jews. We go to the cemetery and we ask the Chevra Kadisha. And then we have an actuary scientist who tells us based on how many Jews were buried in the last year, you can figure out how many Jews there are. Says Ramiel, that's what the Torah wants to say, Lo yia b'hem negef b'fkod osam. That we want Jews, that you don't have to go to the cemetery after death to calculate how many Jews there are. You know, Jewish census is not based on negef, on death. You know, in America at least, and I don't know if this is true throughout the world, you know, to get a Jew sometimes to come to shul, somebody has to die in the family. Even then, I don't know if they'll come to shul, but hopefully they'll come for a Kaddish once in a while. I was in Europe in a few very small towns, as far as Jewish population, I mean. For example, in Athens, I was there when there happened to have been a death. During that 1 week that I was in Athens, the death in the Jewish community, and they actually, all the laws of Avelus went on in the synagogue. I don't think anything, you know, after they left the synagogue, you know, that was it. But in the synagogue, they sat down, and the rabbi had made a whole Hashkavah service, you know, and so forth and so on. So that's Veloya Ben Negev. We don't want to remember Jews who only associate with our people, Bismana Negev, with death. But okay, that's just my drasha for today. In any event, what we want to look at now is Pasuk Tes Zayin, if you still have your Chumash open. V'lakachtas ha-kesef ha-kipurim. Again, the emphasis here is on Kippurim, because, as we said before, that this is kofer nefesh. So if it's kofer nefesh, this kesef could be called kesef ha-kipurim, and it engenders a certain kapara, me'eis b'nei Yisrael. V'nasato sol al avodas ol moed v'hoyel v'nei sol zikaron l'fnei Hashem l'chaper al nafshos seichem. So the emphasis here is on kapara. So we have now two elements here. One element is the counting of B'nai Yisrael. And as far as the census, it seems to be something that's not obligatory but rather voluntary in nature, because the Torah doesn't say Tisa es Rosh B'nai Yisrael. It says Ki Tisa, as if to say, if you decide that for whatever reason you want to take a census, this is the way you have to go about taking account of the Jewish people. So Ki Tisa means Im Tirtza. If you want to count the Jewish people, that's your decision. The Torah tells you, advocates how to do it, describes how to do it without bringing upon yourself a negative. But if, on the other hand, you decide that now's not the right time to take a census, that's okay as well. There's no need for this whole parasha of Machzis HaShekel. That's the first impression you get. But on the other hand, in these other psukim of Kofer Nefesh, L'chaper al Nafsho Seichem, you get the exact opposite impression, that this is absolutely obligatory. Because in order to achieve kapara, this is the way you have to do it. And kapara is an absolute, unconditional obligation. Rashi brings the following drasha. Rashi says that the Machzis HaShekel is collected annually. And of course, this is very relevant to Chodesh Adar, because You know, this is the time in which they collected the Machzis HaShekel. That's why we have a Zechel of Machzis HaShekel around Purim time. And that money was collected for the Trumas HaLishka, for the sake of Karbonas Tzibur. And Rashi adds that there was a special role and function of the Machzis HaShekel during the period of time of the 40 years of the Mishkan, because they needed monies with Tzorech HaAdonim. Adonim are sort of the
sockets.
What do they call the sockets?
Sockets.
Sockets in English. Anyway, so again, we have an absolute necessity and an obligation to collect these funds, whether it's for the Trumas HaLishka, the Karbonas Tzibur, that's in general, meaning even after they entered into the land of Israel, or a specific need and obligation within the 40 years of the desert because of the building of the Mishkan, the Adonim, and so forth. But on the other hand, the backdrop and the framework for this entire mitzvah is Kitiso, which sounds like it's a voluntary mitzvah. If and when we decide that we need a census, you can only take the census by counting these monies. So it's a little bit of a strange kind of integration of both a voluntary mitzvah and an obligatory mitzvah.
You could say that there is a mitzvah, i.e., you have to do it once a year, and when you do it, this is the way to do it.
Right. But my question to you is, since there's an annual obligation to give these funds for those purposes that we mentioned, what is kitis? Excuse me.
When you do it, when you do the annual, this is the way you do it. Kitisa, when you do it, then this is how you do it.
But I'm not sure I understand. Don't you have to do it? Let's say, for example, there was no need to take a census. Or we decide for whatever reason we don't want to take a census.
Right.
There still seems to be an annual mitzvah of Machzis HaShekel.
Yes. And this, yes.
So why does the Torah say ki tisa as if it's voluntary? It's not. It's never going to be. I don't know if you'd ever come. I don't know if you'd ever come to a reality, a scenario in which it's voluntary. Because again, you can use that Machzis HaShekel for the purpose of taking a census, yes. But the words ki tisa mean, and if you decide to take a census, I mean, it doesn't sound like, you know, you have to collect the monies unless you want to take the census. And he says the following. He says that if the purpose of the mitzvah was only to take a census, he says that in the history of Klal Yisrael, if you look at Tanakh, they didn't take the census by collecting money. For example, in Shmuel Aleph, the Torah tells us that at the time of Shaul HaMelech, they had a totally different way of taking a census. They didn't collect monies at all. And in our case, the very odd combination of taking a census with collecting the truma, these monies, leads us to the following ambiguity. You know, we want to take a census, so we're going to count the Machzis HaShekel. When you decide to take a census, the Torah says, then elicit from each one of the people a Machzis HaShekel. Forget about that. You don't need a Machzis HaShekel in order to take a census. And he quotes a number of Mefarshim, the Rashbam and the Ramban, who work very hard to try to work this all out. And he says that Omdu Bifnehem, this is on the third paragraph, if you want to follow me, Mitzvos Machzis HaShekel Uminyan Yisrael. That in fact, there were two independent mitzvahs, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to command and achieve these two mitzvahs. One was the Machzis HaShekel as a contribution, and the other is the minyan, the census of Klal Yisrael. V'karchan HaKadosh Baruch Hu biyachad, and somehow Hashem sort of sewed them together. At the same moment, we should use the Machzis HaShekel for counting Bnei Yisrael. And even though the counting of Bnei Yisrael is a reshus and not a chova, correct? He says that the Lashon of Kitisa is lavdaf, according to these Mefarshim, and really there is a Chova. But again, even if I grant you that Kitisa, with a liberal kind of loose translation, means that you're obligated to count Bnei Yisrael, the integration of these two elements, which seem to be totally independent, meaning the coincidental overlap of number one, the Matzah Shekel as a truma, number two, the Matzah Shekel as a means to fulfill our mitzvah chovah of counting Bnei Yisrael, rationally it leaves us a little bit in the wanting, you know, a little bit, shall I say, not totally rationally satisfied that there's an integration of two things that happened to coincide, meaning it's a nice way of counting Bnei Yisrael, but really the Matzah Shekel is a mitzvah unto itself, independent of counting Bnei Yisrael. So the overlap here is purely coincidental, and that's very difficult. Again, it becomes even more difficult if we assume the Poshim Shat and Kiti, so that the whole thing is voluntary. How could that be voluntary when annually we need and we're obligated to collect, to contribute to Machtis Hashek? So again, just to set the goal for this essay, what we want to find and we want to reveal, if we can, is the relationship between the Machtis HaShekel and the census of Bnei Yisrael. Is there a deeper connection between the two? Now, as far as the Machtis HaShekel is concerned, there is a name of a currency which is not a half of something, but it's a whole, and it's equivalent to a Machtis HaShekel. That's called a Beka, Bet Kuf Ayin. So the next question we want to ask, and sometimes the more questions you ask, the closer you get to an answer, is why is it that the Torah chose to call this a Matzah Shekel, but not a Beka? A third question, and this is perhaps the key to unlock the mystery of what's going on here in this parasha, is that every single Jew, no matter what his financial background was, what his financial status was, he may have been very rich, he may have been very poor, he would have to give a Machtis HaShekel, not more, not less. In the case of an usher, in a sense, you're stifling him. You know, the usher is a big shot. You know, he wants to come forward and say, well, I can pay for the whole thing myself. On the other hand, in the case of the ani, you're really making it very difficult for him because he can't afford a Machtis HaShekel. It's above his budget. But yet the Torah will not be in any way compromising on this issue. The Torah says it's an absolute chiyuv. Everyone gives the same exact amount, and that's the Machtis HaShekel. And again, even though this Machtis HaShekel was used for a truma, and therefore we'd certainly be tempted intuitively to encourage the usher to give more than the Machtis HaShekel, so we'll have enough, you know, we'll be able to fund this community chest as much as we can, but nevertheless, no, it's going to be the exact amount of a Machtis HaShekel. Now, if you go back to Parshas Truma, which is two parshios ago, in Perek Chaf Hey, there, you remember the Torah says, "Kol ish asher yidvenu libo tikhu es trumasi." And there, in the case of Trumas HaMishkan, which was, again, that was a one-time affair. That's not what we're talking about here in Parshas Kitisa. As far as building the Mishkan is concerned, that truma was totally voluntary.
But it was a one-off occasion.
It was one.
One-off.
One-off. It's called. Okay, I'm not familiar with that phrase, but once-in-a-lifetime occasion. Same idea. Okay, and therefore the laws that apply to truma are not meant to teach us anything about Machtis HaShekel. So, for example, Machtis HaShekel is obligatory, whereas Truma is contingent on Kol Ish Asher Yidvenu Libo, if his heart prompts him. It's a voluntary mitzvah, not an obligatory mitzvah. Furthermore, if a person has a great deal of money, he's got wads and wads of bills, he can come and say, I want to contribute major funds for the Truma of building the Mishkan. He's not limited to any, you know, ceiling fund. But the very fact that the Torah, in the case of building the Mishkan, encourages an usher to pay, you know, a suitable and appropriate amount of money, you know, offer a contribution that fits you, because you have the money in the bank. But here, nevertheless, the usher who wants to give for this particular truma, which is again the Trumas HaLishka, not the Mishkan, but the Trumas HaLishka, all of a sudden we put a ceiling and we say, you know what, you may be a wealthy guy, but we don't want your money. That's pretty rare in fundraising, you know. Thanks, but no thanks. I never heard that phrase in fundraising. And he says, even the Dal Yom Lo Yamit, the special prohibition that the poor person is not to give less than a machtzis shekel here in Parsha Haskiti. So that also begs understanding. With regard to every single mitzvah in the Torah, we have a rule of chomesh, which means that a person cannot spend more than 20% of his assets. Let's say I see a beautiful esrog, but I'm a poor guy. The esrog is very expensive. Relative to me, I would have to spend more than 20%. I'm not allowed to do so. Ad chomesh, up to a fifth of my possessions. And here it could very well be that the Beka, otherwise known as the Machtzis Shekel, might exceed 20% of the funds and the finances that this Dal has, his assets in the bank. And nevertheless, he can't do it. He gives an example here. Let's say, for example, a person's total assets are 100, and the Dal Ed Minim will cost 25. That's more than a chomesh. That's a revia. So the law is he's not allowed to buy the dalid minim. He won't have dalid minim on sukkahs. So either he borrows, begs, or whatever. He can't steal it because that would be mitzvah of avera. Or he's anus. He's considered someone who was prevented from fulfilling the mitzvah. He will not be punished for it. But in the case of Machtzis Shekel, which is a mitzvah saseh and is counted as mitzvah saseh, the Ani will have to somehow gather together the Machtzis Shekel, even if it exceeds beyond 20% of his mammon. And that makes this mitzvah a very unique mitzvah within the Taryag mitzvahs. He's going to have to borrow money in order to amass this small fortune, which for him is a big fortune, of Machtzis Shekel in order to do it. Why is that so? One last question before we try to analyze this, and that's the piyut of Rabbi Elezer HaKalir for the Musaf of Parshas Shkolim. Again, I don't know how many people here, I think the Dutch actually still say piyut to this day. Some of the Yekis. But today it's almost, you know, who reads Kalir on Yontif? You know, we have enough trouble with Kalir on Yom HaKippurim, on Tisha B'Av. But in any event, in the piyut for Parsha Shkolim, which a lot of the Hasidim also, by the way, say to this very day, it says, Or Panecha Eleinu Adon Nisa. Niso or Naso, v'shekel esa b'bayis nachon v'naso, and it seems like he's telling us that in Machtzis Shekel, the usher lo yarbe. So what does it mean? Shekel. Shekel is double Machtzis Shekel. He should have said Machtzis Shekel. He's talking about a person who has the funds to afford more than a Machtzis Shekel. But why call it a shekel? Now again, you and I might have said, and we're not bothered by this question, because the Mishnah itself says that Rosh Chodesh Adar Machrizin al Ashkolim. But there it's referring to many different people. Here he's talking about one individual. So it's not really meticulous or accurate to call it a shekel. He should have called it a Machtzis Shekel. Now, you and I know that there's something called literary license. And Rav Elazar Kalir was a great poet. He was a liturgist. He wrote liturgy. But the answer is, Rabosai, there's no license here for making a halachic mistake. Rabbi Elazar Kalir, according to Tosus, was a Tana. Like, I'm not saying the historians don't agree with that. And they seem to have riots that he lived during the time of the Crusades, which doesn't make him a Tana. Makes him a Rishon, but not a Tana. But whoever he was one of the Gedolei Yisrael. And it'll take literally thousands of years until we decipher all the hidden mysteries and the depths of knowledge of Chazal that are condensed in Rabbi Elazar HaKalir's piyutim. He was unbelievable, and my Rebbe would speak sometimes for an hour. I'm not exaggerating, an hour about one line in Rabbi Elazar HaKalir on Tisha B'Av. You know, my Rebbe used to start at 9 a.m. with kinnis, meaning we had finished all davening and everything else. 9 a.m. we started saying kinnis. And we finished at about 5 p.m. Straight, he would go. And he would sit on the floor. But about Chatzos, he would tell us to get up and sit on chairs. He would remain on the floor. And he was a man close to 80. He wasn't a youngster. And he kept going nonstop. And I would say at least 50%, if not 80% of what he spoke about was Rabbi Elazar HaKalir. To be medayik on every word in Rabbi Elazar HaKalir and show you where he was coming from. In any event, that's so now we come to Rav Yaakov Emden. Rav Yaakov Emden takes a look at a Tosfos at the beginning of Bava Basra in the famous Sugya of Tzedakah. You know, if you want to learn about the laws of Tzedakah, Klach Lecha, go study the end of the first parak of Bava Basra. And there, Tosfos asks a question. He says, Moshe Rabbeinu also gave Tzedakah, and of course the highest level of Tzedakah is what we call Matan B'Seser. The recipient doesn't have to know who you are. And the question is, were there Aniyim, were there poor people at the time of Moshe Rabbeinu in the Midbar? Keep in mind that what happened right after Kriyas Yamsuf? What was the immediate episode, so to speak, if you had to give it a title, following Kriyas Yamsuf? Bizas Mitzrayim. You remember Bizas Mitzrayim? That means they just took... They looted, yeah. I mean, the Mitzrayim were down at the bottom of the sea and they took all the wealth, the riches. It was a massive amount of money. So who are these Aniyim that, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu, the Gemara says, was giving Matan B'Seisa to the Aniyim? And he answers the following. He says, just to beef up the question, I mean, what were they spending their money on? Clothing? Food? What were they buying over there? I mean, they lived in tents. Their clothing lasted them the full 40 years. It was a great miracle, and man came down to Shemayim. There were no expenditures, so they were wealthy people. Who are the poor people? So the answer is, Ha'asher lo yarbev adal lo yamit, that there were poor people. Says Rav Yaakov Emden, because Tosfos leaves this question unanswered, he says that, although it's true that when they left Mitzrayim, they all were pretty rich. But he says that everyone was involved in business, in mischar. And if you're on page 190, if you count up about four lines up from the bottom of the page, is he says, Gam ba-midbar, even in the desert, Hayu b'nei Yisrael socharim eluim elu, b'rechush she'roch ashu b'bizas hayam. It's an interesting fact that we never think about this, but Rav Yaakov Emden says that there was a lot of...
Trade,
business deals. People were swapping things. B'kelim she'shilu Mitzrayim, and also with the utensils they took out of Mitzrayim. The Osku im Tagrim ibnei Umas Olam, and there were other travelers that came from other nations into the Midbar. Like, for example, a lot of the water supply could have come from them, in theory, or maybe other things that they needed, they would trade from them. And therefore, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu is gozer chas v'shalom anius on a certain person, that he should be poor, then they would lose in these business investments. And therefore, it's true that although when they left Mitzrayim there were no poor people, but later on during the period and the stretch of 40 years there were poor people. And this leads us back to the idea of the Beis HaMikdash and the Truma of Bnei Israel for the Beis HaMikdash. We know that the purpose of the Beis HaMikdash is Avoda, right? That's called the Avoda. It's one of the three pillars of the earth, is Avoda. When a person has a lot of money that he wants to, you know, it's very flashy and he wants to give a great truma, basically he wants everybody to feel as if they, you know, they owe him. You know, a person donates a synagogue, you know, some people they call it by his name. I know of a synagogue, a major synagogue in the New Jersey area, nobody knows it by its name. They know it by the name of so-and-so who donated the money for the synagogue. It's his shul. And that's true also for a yeshiva, by the way. If you build a yeshiva, one person gives major funds for the yeshiva, he feels himself the baal habos. And he comes in and he tells you what he likes, what he doesn't like, and he runs the show. With regard to the avodah, the Beis HaMikdash, this is a very severe, dangerous situation. People are going to say, well, this rich guy, you know, he controls the Beis HaMikdash. You know, he buys all the karbonos, and karbonos were expensive. Even today, for example, you want to buy an animal, it's more than trei zuze, you know, for a goat. Today, a goat sells for, I think, 500. Not shkolim, I'm talking. I don't know about British pounds, I can't tell you, but any event,
used to be,
and now I hear they're not doing so great. But in any event, that would be Melech HaMashiach is coming when we know that the shekel is worth more than the British pound. If that ever happens. I mean, okay, so he says that that his chelik in the avodas hakorbanos is greater than that of the rest of Bnei Yisrael, and really it's hakol shavim lifnei hamakom. Everyone's equal in front of God when it comes to this level of avoda of sheiris in front of Hashem in the Beis Hamikdash, and therefore it's absolutely critical that the ashir should not be able to add more than what he. Than what the Ani is giving. They're all equal. Again, we haven't yet discussed the Mishkan and Parshas Truma, but that's a different story. And he says the following. He says that as long as the final monies have not come in, he says that, I'm sorry, where am I up to? He says, for example, when you count the census, you know, there are two dimensions. There's the counting of each number as it adds up, and then your ultimate goal, your objective when you count these smaller numbers, is to reach a final number. That final number represents the total count. And he says that these two elements are very critical. Each one has a symbolic message to it. He says the following: when we count Bnei Yisrael, the ultimate number is going to be Shishim Ribu. And all the numbers, as they calculated one by one up till Shishim Ribu, are completely lost in the shuffle because it asks us what the census is. We're not going to remember. Well, you, Avram, you gave number, 500,002. Nobody remembers that anymore. Who remembers me, you, and him? They remember the final count of 600,000. And therefore, he got all the mispar klali. When we finally get to the total number, he says, at this point, if that was the purpose of the counting, then we actually forget or we erase the individual, the identity of the individual within the counting. In other words, we counted the individuals, but that was only in order as a stepping stone to get to the ultimate number, the Mispar Sofi, or the Mispar Chloe. And yeah, what the Torah wants us to remember is that every single individual is important, and his counting, the counting of his Machtzis HaShekel, is critical as one link in the chain, and we would never have arrived at the Mispar Kloli if not for the arithmetic addition of each individual number. So we have to go through the Misparim Baderach, on the way, until finally, after we get all these individuals, we finally reach this ultimate
total.
Correct. So in a sense, what we have is two types or two categories of mizug. Mizug is the Hebrew word for integration or synthesis. We have, number one, a synthesis of individuals in which each individual still maintains his status, his independence, his individuality.
Identity,
excellent. And yet, on the other hand, we have the total number in which the individual and the single numbers are completely lost.
Yeah.
Correct. And that's really what it's all about. It's about this very critical combination of both elements here. And the one who actually embellishes this idea is the Zohar of Rav Shimon bar Yochai, when he speaks about Yehud. Yehud means the destiny or the contribution of every single nefesh be Israel. And each person has his own individual responsibility, his own individual contribution to make. And therefore you can't do what I can do, and I can't do what you can do. But then on top of that, in addition to the identity of every individual, there's also the Mispar Kloli. And the Mispar Kloli, although it's made up of a combination and addition of individuals, nevertheless it creates a whole new entity. And that makes the nation of Israel one indivisible entity. So in truth, we have both at the same time. With regard to the relationship between the individual and the Borei Olam, each individual has his own significance. But on the other hand, in the eyes of the Ribono Shel Olam, there's significance to the Tzibur, to the Klal, because we are an Am Segula. We are a special nation that was taken by HaKadosh Baruch Hu as the chosen nation, the Am Segula, the Otzer, the treasury of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And we have specific roles to play. We have specific responsibilities and obligations that evolve on the tzibur as a tzibur. So, for example, if we want to read the Torah publicly on Monday, Thursday, Shabbos, we need an entire tzibur. You know, less than a tzibur won't do. The chiyuv evolves on the tzibur. If you take a look, for example, at the mitzvah of tefillah, we have two elements. We have tefillah sayochid, and I can daven on my own at home, and we have tefillah satzibur, and the chazor sashatz, and the baruch, and the kedusha, that evolves upon the tzibur as a tzibur. That's a community, an entity that's an indivisible entity unto itself. And therefore we really have to remember at all times both of these dimensions. Am Yisrael cannot become one unified Am Skula without each individual. Every single individual has his unique role and contribution. And without that individual role, we do not create a klal. But on the other hand, the prat, the individual of Am Yisrael, cannot achieve this highest level of perfection without integrating into the klal. So the individual is necessary, is critical. There's no klal without the prat, but on the other hand, there's no prat without the klal. The prat can't live on his own. And the ultimate goal is to create this klal in which every individual is critical, but he is part and parcel of creating a klal. And now we get up to page 192. Chazal tell us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu found the greatest blessing is shalom. And before the Torah was given, Klal Yisrael had to reach this high level of achdus. Vayichan sham Yisrael keneged ahar ki yishecha b'lev echad. If not, then we cannot receive the Torah. So the Torah has to be received not by an amalgamation of individuals, no matter how large that number is, but by a totality and an entity unto itself, which is called Echad. And therefore, we have this perfection that on the one hand, each individual is miyuchad, he's special, but on the other hand, that miyuchadus, that yichud of each individual has to lead to and culminate in a shlemus, a perfection which is called Klal Yisrael. So each person, in a sense, is dependent upon the other members of Klal Yisrael. Everyone is interdependent. V'yachad mashlimet hasheni, and one perfects the other. The prat has to be incorporated into the klal. If he doesn't incorporate himself into the klal, he remains what's called a poresh min hatzibur. He cannot benefit from the perfection of that entity called the klal. And here we get to the yesodas of Beis HaMikdash, which is very similar and parallel to that of Kabbalas HaTorah. When it comes to a makom kadosh, then we need the avodah of Klal Yisrael as a klal. What does Hashem accept with his capital H, willed, capital W? He accepts the avoda of the klal. That's called the Karban Tzibur. And therefore, it's absolutely critical when we talk about a Trumas HaLishka, from which the Karban Tzibur is going to be purchased, that there be this entity called the klal. We have to integrate all the people into one. That's the message of the Machtzis HaShekel. You might ask, why did the Torah call it a machtzis hashekel? Why not just call it a beka? The answer is, the machtzis means it's incomplete. I give a machtzis hashekel, I am incomplete on my own. As important as a role I will play and a contribution I will make as an individual, but nevertheless, we need these, that the Beis HaMikdash, the avoda, the karbonos come from the klal. And therefore I'm only a machtzis hashekel. I have to understand and appreciate my incompleteness. And the Adonim represent the basis and the fundamental part of HaKamas HaMishkan. And when HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives us the command to count Bnei Yisrael, what is the significance of that command? And again, we're assuming like those Mepharshim that Kitisa is actually a chova. It means count each individual. Emphasize the significance, the primary paramount significance of every individual. The Torah says, though, to each individual, you're not giving a beka, you're giving a machtzis, to teach each individual that he, on his own, is only a chelek, he's only a fraction, he's not complete. Every single individual is necessary, and we have to collect from every individual, but it's only yachtov, only when we synthesize, integrate them all together, then we get to the perfection of the klal, which is a precondition in building the Beis HaMikdash, in buying the karbanos from the karban, from the trumas halishka. Now we begin to understand why dafka in the counting, the census of Bnei Yisrael, we have the counting for the matzah shekel of the contribution to the karbanos hatzibur. These two ideas really integrate to form one idea, counting the individuals and creating the klal, which is a precondition for the karbanos and the avoda of the Beis HaMikdash. So it's the individual and the emphasis on his contribution, and the klal and the emphasis on shleimut, on that perfection of the klal. And that's really the main breakthrough of this presentation. We'll embellish it a little bit more with the Gemara in Tainus that says that it's not enough to learn Torah on one's own. I see a lot of people, I'm a little upset about it, and sometimes I'm guilty of this, of learning on their own. Sometimes it's necessary to learn on one's own because, you know, you're learning something that you have to prepare and no one else is on board with you. But if things are ideal, then we learn what's called bitzavta, which means bichavrus. And the Gemara has very harsh words about Talmidei Chachamim who maybe sit together physically in the same room, but they don't study together, bichavrusa. And that's a pasuk in Yirmiyahu, cheref al abadim v'no alu. And the Gemara says that these represented Talmidei Chachamim that are learning, and if they're bad bivad, if they are integrated together, then that becomes the highest level of Talmud Torah. That's called mischadedes shmuasam, meaning you ask me a question, I ask you a question, and together we sharpen it out, we work it all out. But in lav, if they're not learning bitzavta bad bivad, if there's no yachtov, then not only are they going to be unsuccessful in their Torah study, but it's even worse than that. Mitapshit means they're going to pervert the Torah, chas v'shalom. And that is a sin unto itself. And therefore it's the same idea that we've been discussing with of the machtis hashekel. Each individual is incomplete. He needs a chaver, he needs a chavruso, chavruso mesusa. He has to have what's called dibuk chaverim. And when they have dibuk chaverim, they all get together and they form one. That's the unit that represents the klal. That's the powerful shlemus of the group. And therefore, a person should be very well advised to learn from his friend, understanding and appreciating that his friend has a certain uniqueness, he also has a unique approach, and together they can, you know, sharpen the sugya very well, they can, you know, churn out a beautiful whole. And that's the significance of getting together as one entity. And the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed according to the sugya Masechta Gittin, it's also Masechta Yuma, not because of the three cardinal sins. That's true for the Bayis Rishon, but in the case of Bayis Sheni, they were guilty only of Sinas Chinam. And again, this idea of Sinas Chinam means that each individual thinks he's the greatest, he has the special status and contribution to make, he doesn't appreciate the others. Sonim Elu Es Elu, that's called Sinas Chinam. And Sinas Chinam, the Gemara tells us, is Shkula Keneged Avodah Zarah. I don't see that. Oh, I'm sorry, it's Yerushalmi. That's why I don't see it. Because I never learned Yerushalmi, I have to admit. And except it when it Tosfos quotes Yerushalmi. That's how I know Yerushalmi. Today it's coming more into fashion to study Yerushalmi. So Michael, after you finish Babli for the next, I don't know how many times around you've gone, but then you might start the Yerushalmi. In any event, the Yerushalmi says that Sinas Chinam is equivalent to Avodah Zarah, Gilayis, and Shvichas Dovim. It's almost equivalent to all three together. And again, we begin to understand and appreciate Rabbi Lazar Kalir, who says Shekel Esa. And why doesn't he say Machzis HaShekel Esa? You know, it's like I would contribute half of a shekel. He says that this is a tefillah in which we are asking Hashem Yisbarach Sheyisa Lanu Panim. And what does that mean? Yisa Lanu Panim means we're asking in an ideal sense that God bring about excuse me, the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash, and we want to restore the Avodas Beis HaMikdash. Therefore, what are we saying? We're saying to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that we want to do tshuva for Sinas Chinam. Sinas Chinam was the cause of the destruction of the second temple. And how do we bring this about? How do we do tshuva for Sinas Chinam? And the answer is that Shekel Esa, what does that mean, Shekel Esa? What does HaKalir have in mind? He says, every single individual should try to be Mizdaveg Im Chavero B'dibu Chaver. That's a very flowery, poetic language. Each individual has to try to integrate himself with his friend to create a Dibu Chaverim. This is going to be the Ava that's going to replace the Sinah. That's going to be the rectification of the sin that brought about the destruction. And what does it mean? It means that you and I are each a half a shekel, but together we form, with our Dibu Chaver, without Ava, with our Ava, a shekel. So in the context of our prayer to bring about the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash, we bring a shekel. What does it mean, we bring a shekel? Not I bring a shekel. I can only bring and contribute a half a shekel, but together we will bring a full shekel. And now Rabbi Elazar Kalir is very sharp. And finally, he says, why is the mitzvah machzis ha-shekel so unique that a person can't give more if he's a rich person or less if he's a poor person, as opposed to every other mitzvah? Focus, for example, on the dal, right? He's the poor person, and he's not allowed to give 25% of his assets for a mitzvah of lulav, a mitzvah of matzah, mitzvah of sukkah. And the only exception to that rule is Chanukah, because Chanukah has a special status in which we force a person, if he's poor, to go around knocking on doors and selling the shirt off his back in order to fulfill the mitzvah of Chanukah because of the Persume Nisa of Chanukah. And the Avnei Nezer is famous for saying in Hilchus Tzedakah that if a person had in mind to do a mitzvah, but circumstances prevented him from implementing that mitzvah, there was a barrier, then the Torah considers it as if he did the mitzvah. Why? Because ones kemandi ovid domi. With regard to mitzvahs, Hashem, at least mitzvahs benon lemakom, at least Hashem considers it as if I did the mitzvah. I was really ready, prepared to do the mitzvah. So let's say, for example, I didn't have the assets to buy a lulav, meaning it would be cost me more than 20% of my assets to buy a lulav. So Hashem will say, you know, it's as if you did the mitzvah. However, that doesn't apply in the case of tzedakah, a ben adam lechavero. An ani comes and he's asking us for food, and the Baal Bayis who answers the door, he says, I don't have the money, I don't have the assets, the wherewithal to supply you with tzedakah. And even though it's not my fault, these are circumstances beyond my control, but nevertheless, even with all my good intentions to help him, Lamaisa, at the end of the day, he didn't receive anything. In this case, says the Avnei Nezer, there's no principle of ones kimandi ovid avdinon. If the poor person walks away poor and hungry, then with all due respect, you know, you'll get a certain schar for your intention and your will, but you don't get the schar of the mitzvah of tzedakah. And ones kimandi ovid is only in a mitzvah ben adam lemakom. HaKadosh Baruch Hu could say, you were on your way to do the mitzvah, you were ready and eager to do the mitzvah, you were prevented from doing so, I'll consider this and give you the reward as if you did the mitzvah. And that's called ben adam lemakom. But ben adam lechaver is a whole different kind of a mitzvah. Here the mitzvah is in the fulfillment, just give me a second, because I had a word, the culmination, just one second, I'm looking for a word, the toksad, meaning the final result, meaning the final result here of all your efforts is what's critical, meaning that the recipient has what he needs. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu could give you credit on the level of Bein Adam LaMakom, and every Bein Adam LaChaveru has Bein Adam LaChaveru element, but in terms of Bein Adam LaChaveru is concerned, it all depends upon the Totsah Metziutit, as he calls it, that the Ani has to benefit, and the hungry person has to have food to eat. You know, your theoretical calculation that it's as if you did it doesn't help the Ani at all. So the purpose of the mitzvah, the essence of the mitzvah, is the Ani, the recipient. And the Sukkot of a Rebbe wants to explain based on this the din of Chanukah. This is wild. Chanukah, I would have said, is Bein Adam LeMakom. But he says the following, that the essence of Chanukah is Pirsum Hanes. And Pirsum means vis-a-vis others. I publicize the miracle so that you can know about the miracle. Here too, the fact that I was Anus and I couldn't afford, you know, the Shemen Shebener, and I didn't light the Ner Chanukah, that doesn't help anybody else. There's no Pirsum Hanes. Pirsum Hanes is dependent upon a reality, a Metzius, not on all your good intentions, all your Kavanos. And therefore, Nenas Velo Hidlik, it's not considered as if he did the mitzvah because he wasn't successful in creating a Pirsum Hanes. And therefore, the Halach has no, how should I say, no compassion on him. He's got to knock on doors, he's got to borrow money, sell his clothes in order to fulfill and create this Pirsum Hanes. And if we use that model of the Avnei Nezer with regard to Tztok or Pirsum Hanes and apply it to the case of Machzis HaShekel, here's what we get. When a person gives a Machzis HaShekel, the essence of the mitzvah is linking up in a partnership for the other half of a shekel with another member of Klal Yisrael, and ultimately with all Klal Yisrael. If the Ani will be chaser me'aminyan, yafsidu kulam. If, let's say, the Ani can't afford that machzis ha-shekel, and if he doesn't participate in this mitzvah, then everyone's going to lose as a result. Why is everyone going to lose as a result? Because again, the mitzvah of machzis ha-shekel is to help the next one. Right? I contribute towards you and you towards me. But if you're not there as an Ani to receive, then I haven't given anything. Vareu chav lachrini, you know, it would be very nice for the Ani to say, well, look, I can't afford it. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu considered me an Anus, and Anus command the Ovid Amrinon, you know, that's in Beinom L'Chaver Hashem. I really wanted to give the Chatzi Shekel, I just don't have the assets in the bank. Hashem consider it, please, as if I did the mitzvah. And that's the rule that applies to all Bein Adam LaChaver, but this is going to be the exception. I'm sorry, that's the rule that applies to all Bein Adam LaMakom, and this is going to be the exception. Why? Because the whole concept of Mas HaShekel is a partnership in which we participate together. I give you half a shekel, you give me half a shekel, together we put it in a pot. You know, we join forces and we have a partnership of a shekel, of a complete shekel. If the Ani will be left off, he will be,
deficient.
Just give me a minute. If the Ani will be exempt, right, if he'll be exempt from this obligation, that's going to be chav lacherim. That's at the expense of someone else. Because we need that Ani in order to participate in this partnership and create a full shekel. And therefore, the Ani cannot claim, well, it's more than 20% of my assets, ones command the Ovid. No, there's no ones command the Ovid at the expense, at the deficit of someone else. And if the Ani doesn't participate, then the Asher is at a loss. And therefore it becomes like the Pirsum Hanes of the Sukkot Shavuot, that if I don't light Ner Chanukah, you lose, because my mitzvah is to reveal to you the nature of this miracle. And finally, at the end of our discussion, we have the last part of the parasha, which is the mitzvah of the kiyar, which is called in English the sink, or the lavra. L-A-V-R-A?
Is that L-A-V-E-R.
L-A-V-E-R. Okay, the laver. Right? The laver.
Means to wash.
To wash. Okay, good. See, I don't know French. That's my problem. You know, I was in Canada for 2 years. I didn't learn a word of French. Maybe had I been in Montreal, it would have been different.
You had to read the cereal boxes.
Yeah, the cereal boxes. Right. Yeah. So he says that the Gemara in Masechet Zvachim on our parsha, if you could open up the Chumash to Shmos Mem, Pasuk Lamed Aleph. This is, I think, next week's parsha. Wait one second. Let's see. Oh, it's actually Pekudei. There's no double parsha this year, is it? Is there? I think it's single. Okay. And what does it say in Parshas Pekudei? Let's look at Pasuk Lamed Aleph. This is at the bottom of your page 235. It says, "Varachatzu bimenu Moshe v'Aaron u'banaves yedehem v'es raglehem." That the kiar is designated, this laver, for kiddush yadayim v'raglayim. And halacha is that the kiar has to be of a certain size that it could hold a volume of water, which is enough to be makadesh for kohanim at the same time, because it says Moshe, it says Aaron, and then it says banov in plural. So that's a minimum of four people. So imagine four people have to enter in with their hands and their feet into this laver that's got to have a certain size. And we derive from this that Bizman Atzivu Hayu Aaron Elazar Itamar Pinchas Imohim. Wow. So it's not just Moshe and Aaron in Bono, but it's also the four children here. We have three children.
After you took out Barabavir, what's left?
Left. So what we have altogether is four Kohanim. And this is how the Rambam codifies it in Bias Migdash Perkei. In any event, perhaps what's happening is, why do we need these four Kohanim to wash their hands and feet at the same time in this laver? It seems very strange. You know, I remember today I was at the Kotel because my grandson put on tefillin for the first day at the time at the Kotel. So I was waiting online to wash my hands, you know, and they didn't have enough room for four people at once. They did, but, you know, all four positions were taken at that time. So he says the following. Kasher nigash hakohen lavodasa bebeis hamigdash kinitzig klal Yisrael. We have to understand that when the kohen prepares himself through kiddush yadayim v'raglayim, his avoda is to stand as the representative of klal Yisrael. The first thing he has to do, therefore, is wash his hands and his feet. And therefore, this kohen, has to understand, has to be cognizant of the fact that it's not just ani, it's not just I. You know, and I myself can do the job of representing Klal Yisrael. But rather, he's totally b'koinim achirim. There's got to be a very clear message that penetrates his heart that he is totally dependent upon other koinim. He can't do it himself. Again, I'm not sure why the number four is critical here, but he says, kol echad b'Yisrael toli b'chavero. Every Jew is dependent upon another Jew. And this is the law of Chayovim Lios B'Mishmar, every Mishmar of Kohuna, which was a group, a unit of Kohanim in charge of the Avodah for that day, had to be comprised of a minimum of four Kohanim. Four Kohanim Ru'uyim La'Avodah. So the unit of Avodah is a minimum of four, otherwise it's not a unit. And let's say, for example, some of the Kohanim, they tell you that they can't come in today. They're sick, they're ill. So then you're going to have to bring in the next Mishmar to replace this Mishmar. Because we must have a Mishmar of a plural of four Kohanim in order to represent Klal Yisrael. And one Kohen just can't do it. The same thing we find in the Ketores. We need all 13 Samamonim to make up the Ketores. One of them is called Chelbina, which the Gemara says increases his Recha Ra. It has a bad, foul odor. And on its own, you wouldn't be able to tolerate its odor, but if you add it together with the other 12 samimonim and you make the ketores, then not only is the chelbana no longer have a foul odor, but it even enhances the odor of the other 13, of the other 12 samimonim. And the Gemara derives from this the principle that called Tainus She'in Ein Imam Miposhe Yisrael Lav Tainus, that when you gather the community together to fast on a Tainus, a public fast, that you have to invite the Avaryonim, even the criminals of Israel, to also join in. They represent the Chelvon, and somehow when they come and join the community, it even enhances the community. It's a mind-boggling concept. And the same is true for any avoda. The avoda has to represent not just the great, righteous, holy people of Klal Yisrael, but also the Poshe Yisrael. And here we have a very extreme expression of the concept of Klal Yisrael, that even the Poshim, even those who rebel against Hashem, Chas V'Sholom, they also have to be partners in the Avodas HaKarbonim, Karbonos of the Tzibur, without any exception to the rule. So Rabbi Bosa, if we just quickly give a bottom line overview of Parashas Ki Tisa, over and over again in this parasha, the Torah emphasizes that we cannot come totally alone as individuals in front of the Ribono Shel for Avoda, but rather we have to come together with others, we have to join hands in becoming a unified unit, a community, and that community is greater than the sum of its parts. It's an indivisible entity called the Klal, and the counting of Bnei Yisrael represents the, on the one hand, emphasis on each individual member and his unique role. We're going to count his separately, but the Klal is something that emerges after all the Pratim are added together. A new entity emerges called the Klal, which has a shlemus that allows a mitzvah of avoda, a mitzvah of tefillah, a mitzvah of haktores haktores, and all that the Kohanim have to do on behalf of Klal. So Yirotza, maybe his will, that would be zoche, to be dovek, echad b'chavero, which would be bad bebad, and creating that unity of ish echad b'lev echad, we should be able to both mekabel Torah and rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, rectify the sin of Sinas Chinam, Bimhera V'Yameinu. Okay. This was a lot easier than last week, which was Yeshus Behed, you know, for those who who followed that. So for those who want to learn a little Bava Kama, Beis Hashem will come back in 15 minutes and we'll study. I just want to tell you where we're up to for those who might want to get a head start here. We have a very interesting sugya today. Hopefully we'll understand it well, and that's going to be on Kuf Ches on the Beis Boy Rav. Okay then, so Mirz Hashem, in a few minutes we'll come back.